This is, as you will see, the second session, and the second session, in a way, takes a bit of a step back and talks about the nature of EU diplomacy in a changing environment for diplomacy in general. When David asked me to, in a sense, put down my discussant's comments before I'd seen the papers, I thought, that's strange. But then I thought, actually, it helps you to concentrate your mind about what the session should be about. So really, this session is about how the European Union and the External Action Service fit, in a way, within a world of diplomacy, and in a way fit conceptually in terms of the development of diplomacy and the characteristics of diplomacy. Procedurally, as part of a global diplomatic process or a set of diplomatic processes, and politically, as part of a political process, as we saw in the previous session, one of the things that you can't detach from diplomatic activity is the political context and the way in which the politics comes through. And we have two people here who can help us a lot to understand this kind of context. The first of them on my left is Joseph Batora, who's going to talk about the way in which the European Union has developed its diplomacy. And as you can see, he's trying to extend our diplomatic vocabulary just a little bit. The mitrailleurs and the interstitial characteristics of EU diplomacy. And on my right is Christian Lequin from Sciences Po, and he's going to speak second and take up the themes as well. So I'm going to do what every chairman should really do, is just get out of the way, and they're each going to speak for about 15 minutes, and then I may make some brief remarks, then we'll get into discussion. So, Joseph.
Thanks very much, Mike, and good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. And
is it on?
Is it on now?
Yeah, it's the distance, okay. Which is not
all right, should work now. Good afternoon. It's a great pleasure to be here. And now, as Mike said, the name of the title of the presentation is The Mitrailleuse Effect, and the reason for it is, of course, that we have Christian Lequin on the panel. So I thought that would be a bit of a tribute to him. No, but the real reason is that the reason why I chose this title is that this all is, of course, a French complot with the aim of locking the Brits into some kind of a European. No, again, that's not the reason. But the reason is a metaphor that I use for what the External Action Service is about. Now let me start us off by the metaphor, and here is a picture. Some of you might not see it too well, but this is something which certainly looks like a cannon. But indeed, this is la mitrailleuse. This is indeed the first prototype of machine gun that the French military had available and had created in the 1870s. Late 1860s. Now, when the Prusso-French War was going on, when the Prussians had invaded France in 1870, the French military already had about 250 of these available in their units. However, this was a combination, this was a new kind of a weapon. This was a combination of rifles and of artillery, of cannons. Now, what happened to these weapons was that they got put back behind the lines with the artillery units because this looked like cannons. Indeed, the actual founder of these weapons, the constructor of those weapons, had 5 years after the conflict ended still been thinking about this as a new type of cannon which was going to revolutionize the artillery tactics. It took several decades before the actual potential of machine guns was actually understood. It was, of course, during the First World War. And it completely transformed the way war was being conducted, as you know, during the trench warfare of the First World War. So my argument is that the External Action Service of the European Union runs the risk of being misconceptualized the same way we have been misconceptualizing the first type of machine gun. Now, that's la mitrailleuse. So what exactly is the EAS? And the reason why I what brought me to think about the EAS was my miscontention. I was not satisfied with the kind of labels it was being given. First of all, is this really a sui generis organization? Well, that's the usual way it's being labeled. It's, of course, a lawyer's phrase, but of course it's also used by many social scientists who call it a sui generis organization. Now, I'm sure you would agree with me that in the social world and in the natural world, there is nothing which is sui generis. Everything is the result of the actual existing resources, of a recombination of various kinds of resources. Now, the second thing, is this really diplomatic service? I would argue that this is really using the label diplomatic service on the External Action Service is really conceptually blinding us from getting a proper grip on what the service is actually about. Now, a little bit of theory. Now, what would be the sources of social innovation in general? We could argue that the social structure of organizations is could be defined as groups, institutions, laws, population characteristics, and sets of social relations that form the environment of the organization. This is a definition given by American organization theorist Art Stinchcomb. We could also think about the environment when new organizations are being created as a genetic soup of various kinds of models of proper organizing. So whenever a new organization is founded, whether that be a new university, a new ministry, a new school, it always looks and works in a densely populated environment of various other kinds of institutions already available, of models available for organizing. So the sources of innovation and new ways of organizing are never anything which is coming out of itself, out of being sui generis. It's always a result of combination and recombination of available resources. Now, the External Action Service certainly also is being created in a highly in a densely populated, institutionalized environment of diplomacy, which has very clear ideas about what foreign services and diplomatic services do, how they are organized, and what they're expected to do. Now, here's a little model of what I would call an organizational field of foreign services, of foreign ministries, where we have the triangles. There, those would be the foreign ministries, and there's a field in between them, which means that when a new foreign ministry is founded, such as the Foreign Ministry of Slovakia in 1993 or that of Norway in 1905, there are some really clear ideas about how what the foreign ministry is to do and how it is to be organized. You simply couldn't scratch all of it and go away from the existing models. Now, of course, the External Action Service is being founded in this highly or densely populated institutional environment. So the question could, of course, be raised, is one of these triangles the External Action Service? Now, certainly partly, but not only that. The External Action Service, as I will argue, is an interstitial organization, that is, an organization which is emerging in interstices between various organizational fields and recombining physical, informational, financial, legal and legitimacy resources stemming from organizations belonging to these different organizational fields. It's something in between. It's the same thing like the alternative conflict resolution, which you have outside of courts, right? All kinds of mediation techniques that are emerging, where you have all sorts of organizations emerging outside of established institutionalized spheres. So there are at least three dimensions in which the External Action Service is interstitial. It is first of all interstitial in relation to EU institutions. Of course, this is a well-known fact that the staff is being drawn from at least three sources. It's the Council, it's the Commission, and of course the Member States. But then indeed, if we look at the foundation and the creation of the External Action Service, it was created really fast and took over virtually the entire set of administrative procedures from the Commission, including IT systems and all sorts of administrative culture. So what Robert Cooper was talking about as the curse of the Commission procedures, that's indeed there. But the reason for it is that it needed to be created during the Christmas break, Christmas holiday of 2009, because as you remember, after the Lisbon Treaty was passed, there wasn't enough time to really prepare it. So it was like performing, as David O'Sullivan was saying, and Cesare Onestini, I think, also will say, it was like performing a reparation on a running car engine. And that's why you simply had to, they hit the ground running and they had to, you know, take over a set of procedures which was available. Now, the dominance of the commission procedures in the service is also related to the fact that the transfer of staff from the commission to the external action service was done in batches. That means in whole units, while as from the council and from the member states, they were coming in individual, more or smaller groups. Moreover, if we look at the kind of resources, physical resources of the External Action Service, the first 2 years of operation, they've been working in 7 buildings around Brussels. Now they are only in 2. The new headquarters are available, and they've already moved into those. However, and there's of course also the SITS and the crisis management units, which are in a separate building for security reasons. Now, what has happened, of course, the way it was created was that some of the units had actually stayed in, especially the commission units, had stayed in the same buildings and the same rooms they've been using for a number of years before. The only thing that changed were door tags and their business cards. Of course, in terms of public communication, they're also interstitial with the commission and with the council. If you look at the way how the External Action Service now, for instance, manages its press releases, it is all being managed and communicated via the council. Why is that? Well, there are thousands of email addresses that are registered with the council, and of course it would have to be done individually to transfer those to the External Action Service, which would be a tremendous operation. So they keep on using council services, and so when people get press releases from the External Action Service, it always goes to the council. The same goes for all kinds of public databases, including the Europa Portal, where of course, the External Action Service is listed under the council. This was changed in May this year. However, some, for instance, French databases, quite well-known Trombinoscope, the French will know it, which lists about 25,000 people in the French public administration, but also in EU institutions, French people working in EU institutions, lists the EAS under the council. Now, when the EAS approached Trombinoscope, the editors of that, and they asked, you know, can you move us and create us as a separate institution? They'd say no, because the Europa Portal lists you as under the council. So there are all kinds of hang-ups like that. In relation to the member states, there's also an interstitial positioning of the External Action Service. First of all, this relates to diplomatic legitimacy and recognition. The EU is not a state, and therefore it is creating its diplomatic capacities in a kind of a legal lacuna. It is not clear that the EU should have a diplomatic status. This has, of course, this has had all kinds of implications. That is the reason why the heads of delegations are called heads of delegations and not ambassadors. That's why the EU delegations are called delegations and not embassies. And of course, in terms of recognition, the EU cannot recognize states, other states. They cannot perform a core function of diplomacy, the constitutive function of diplomacy, and that is recognition. That has to be done by member states. So it is practically dependent on those legitimacy and recognition resources of the member states. It is also dependent on the legitimacy resources and legal resources of the member states in terms of diplomatic passports. The EAS, as a diplomatic service, does not have diplomatic passports, does not issue diplomatic passports. What the EAS personnel has, they have what they call laissez-passer, which is a lower-level diplomatic travel document which allows you to travel to a particular destination but doesn't provide you the same kind of rights and immunities as diplomatic passports. Now, the EAS personnel have their diplomatic passports issued by their own member states from where they come from. Some of the member states do that, some other member states don't, but there isn't any kind of clear standardization here. Now, there's also an interstitial positioning of the External Action Service at the moment in relation to what we could call institutionalized models of proper organizing. Now, the obvious organizational field to which the External Action Service belongs is, of course, the field of foreign ministries. And indeed, Catherine Ashton and a number of leading echelons of the service have been referring to this as a foreign service in the making. And we have seen that in the debate today and on other fora. So that is clear that this is, Catherine Ashton has been saying that she her aim is to create the best diplomatic service in the world. So this is a clear source of organized models for what the service is to do and what it is to look like. However, if we look at the organizational setup of the External Action Service, there's certainly also a second field to which they would belong, and that is, of course, the defense ministries. Because as we look at the personnel of the External Action Service, at least a half of the people that work for the External Action Service in the extended configuration is, in fact, in the crisis management sector. So about 4,000 people are working in the crisis management sphere. The EAS manages a number of crisis management operations, including the Atalanta and a number of others, which actually is where it is in charge of a number of of military resources deployed by the EU in crisis management operations around the world. A classical example of this would have been what happened in May to this year, which was a first of its kind attack by an EU force on a pirate layer on the coast of Somalia. Now, there was an interesting combination of diplomatic and military resources that was deployed, because after helicopter gunships deployed in the operation destroyed and burned down the pirate layer, hours after that, EAS personnel from the diplomatic part and from the development part would arrive on the scene and explain to the locals why this was important and how important it would be to have development without piracy. And of course, the third dimension or third source of models here would be global corporations. If we look at the setup, organizational setup of the headquarters of the External Action Service, it is quite clear that many of the models of how they are organized is actually drawn from the corporate sector. This includes, of course, the use of corporate labels, such as the corporate board, and I'm sure Cesare Onestini will talk about that. But also the labels of managing directors, as well as models of how you organize space in the service, right? Because as you, some of you may know, the open office solutions that were introduced in the External Action Service are not quite the usual thing in foreign ministries. They're much more usual in multinational corporations. That same goes for security solutions that were introduced, because on the corners of the External Action Service headquarters in Brussels, as you know, there are nice cafes where you can go have lunch right on the corner underneath, which of course is not a solution, again, which is in line with the kind of diplomatic mindset of protecting buildings and information. What does this interstitial nature of the External Action Service tell us about the processes and dynamics of innovation in diplomacy? Well, first of all, we could argue that it brings ambiguity into the fields of diplomacy, because the EAS doesn't harbor only classical diplomatic roles. Many of their roles, be that personnel from the development sector or from the DG RELEX, would be what we would label non-diplomatic. There'd be new kinds of practices or non-diplomatic kinds of practices which are related to defense, to the corporate world. And, of course, there are all kinds of ambiguity related to the actual issue of who represents. This is something which the Slovak diplomats have been grappling with, for instance, in Washington, D.C., where they, of course, ask who is actually representing Slovakia in Washington, D.C.? Is it us or is it the EU delegation? And in what issues does the EU delegation represent us if there is such a situation? Of course, the interstitial positioning of the External Action Service, we could also argue, increases the heterogeneity of the field of diplomacy, because the EAS is in the field of diplomacy, but it is not off the field of diplomacy. It is different than the rest. This, of course, brings in innovation, because this is general observation from organization theory studies of diverse organizational fields. Diversity brings about innovation, because to accommodate diversity, you have to find new ways. So the other foreign services in the system have to find ways how to accommodate the new member. And finally, we could also raise the question whether the EAS, in fact, represents an avant-garde form of the foreign ministry. Because if we look at reform efforts in foreign ministries around the world, and some of the most advanced foreign ministries, let's say the Canadian DFAT, the FCO, the French foreign ministry, the German foreign ministry, the Dutch foreign ministry, what they do, of course, in operations in places like Afghanistan, they try to implement all kinds of integrated and whole-of-government approaches to development, combining development, defense, and, of course, diplomacy. Now, if we look at some of the studies of these comprehensive 3D approaches, these have in governments in the UK, in the Netherlands, and other places have been really grappling with tough coordination efforts, while as the EAS might be, in fact, the first foreign ministry which has actually brought all of that under one roof. So my question here wouldn't be what the EAS can learn from the FCO, but what the FCO can learn from the EAS. So the question is, of course, is the oddity, what's going to happen? Will it be oddity or standardization of the EAS? And of course, when I say oddity, I of course refer to the odd bods quote by Jack Straw in 2004 when he talked about the commission delegations around the world, when he said that these were these odd bods who were manning these odd offices, and he didn't really know what they do. Now I wonder whether this difference is actually the new diplomatic standard. That means the 3D kinds of integrated whole of government approaches, which are not entirely classically diplomatic. So the systemic question that I raise is whether diplomacy will standardize the EAS, or whether the EAS will actually contribute to the transformation of diplomacy. And the issue, of course, for us is to come back to the image in the beginning and to think about the EAS. Are we really able to grasp its actual potential, or is it going to take decades, like in the case of the mitrailleuse? Thank you.
Thanks very much, Chris. Thanks very much, Joseph. Now we move on to Christian.
Thank you very much.
You might need to press that.
Use this. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I guess.
All right.
Stereo now, okay. Well, I would like to start with thanking the organizer, Winhub Place, Charleman Trust, and LSE. Thank you very much to David Spence. Great pleasure to see David again after so many years, because I think first time we met was probably 30 years ago, David, in a Franco-British research project. I am currently working on EAS, and I am supposed to react to Joseph's presentation. First thing I would like to say is Joseph, in his presentation, does not insist too much on the fact that the EAS could be a political body to give more impulse to the EU foreign policy. It was relatively clear, I think, in his presentation that the EAS should be considered more as a bureaucratic agency, as a foreign ministry, as a department, to help the making of foreign policy in a multi-level polity. And I must say that I do agree with that. I think the question we can ask about the EAS have to do more with bureaucracy than with, well, politics. If you're doing a normative analysis, maybe you could say, well, sadly, or something like this, but this is not what a social scientist like to do. Normative questions are usually questions for practitioners and also for think tanks. I think we have to assume also that EU foreign policy is not only what is produced in Brussels, but this is what is produced in Brussels plus the national diplomacies. It's going together. That's the definition I will give from the EU foreign policy, and we understand that the question of coherence, the question of consistency, which is coming all the time in the literature, is of course at the heart of this foreign policy. But we don't have to consider that this is something specific to the EU, or sometimes we overemphasize the sui generis aspect of this multi-level foreign policy, because we also mythologize the centrality of state in the shaping of foreign policies. If you are looking inside the state, comparative studies will show you that there is also a huge fragmentation of the foreign policy making between the ministries of foreign affairs and the other ministries. That coordination is a question which is all the time at the agenda of the states. And if you go to federal states like Belgium, Canada, etc., then the question of coordination is always emphasized, because you have also to coordinate with the subnational governments. Okay, so my message is just to say, do not consider that the states are central, effective in what they are producing in terms of foreign policy versus the EU, you know, which is not effective because it's a multi-level policy. First question which has been raised by Joseph, and which is very often raised in the literature, is a question of coherence. My impression is that you have two dimensions in this question of coherence. You have the problem of the horizontal coherence between the EAS now and the other EU institutions, and you have the problem of the vertical coherence between the EAS and the 27 member states. Ideally, the EAS has been created to reduce the transaction costs. My impression is vis-à-vis the other EU institutions, and especially vis-à-vis the Commission, it has not reduced the transaction cost, but it has increased the transaction costs. You have a lot of negotiations all the time, bureaucratic negotiation. Well, due to the history of the EAS, every institution has its own history, and we should not forget that the EAS has been created in a relative opposition with the Commission, because the Commission had to lose some of its bureaucratic power. And what we have today is just the result of the turfed wars which happened during the negotiation. But what is interesting, as usual in the EU, is now to study how the actors from the EAS and from the Commission try to work together to invent procedure to overcome the problem of distrust and the problem of competition. And my impression from empirical research is that you have a network form of creation of new procedures, because people want to do something with their colleagues from the Commission, so try to create networks. And this is, again, something you find very often in the decision-making of the EU. And what is interesting is also the next stage. When you have this next work, it's institutionalization. When the Director of General of DEFCO and the Secretary General of the EAS decide the establishment of common procedures with an exchange of letters, etc., then it is a new stage, which is the stage of institutionalization. But this is probably the coordination where the situation is the most difficult in terms of finding compromises. My impression is that it is not so difficult and some maybe paradoxically, in the vertical sense of the coordination with the member states. From interviews with national diplomats, you can see, for instance, that you have a lot of positive remarks about permanent chairmanship of the committees or even the permanent chairmanship of the Political Security Council, because it now belongs to an official of the ES, Swedish diplomat Olof Skog. National diplomats, and I would say even British and French diplomats, would say that it provides more continuity to the agenda than the rotating presidencies in the past, and they accept the legitimacy of this permanent chairperson in Brussels without too much resistance. That's something which is interesting when you're doing interviews. In the EU delegation, the task of the head of delegation, organizing meetings, etc., is also something which is probably less conflictual than in the past, because now you have legal obligations. Okay, so when you have text, when you have legal obligation, it also force the national ambassadors to accept the coordination. But of course, you have limits to that. And if I'm talking about, relationships with bilateral embassies in third states, limits is a certain number of topics, for instance, consular cooperation. In consular cooperation, you have a certain number of member states. Let's say, even if we are in London, it's clear for the British Foreign Office, opposed to a Europeanization of consular protection, such as the evacuation of civilian in times of crisis to avoid operation that the FCO doesn't necessarily want to pay for. So when this question of consular protection is sometimes put at the agenda of coordination meetings in the third countries, it's clear that here you could see very quickly the limits. But giving the power to coordinate to the EU heads of delegation does not mean that the heads of delegation have the power. We should not be confused when we're talking about coordination. It does not mean having the power. I'm not sure that the most powerful European diplomat in Beirut today is the head of delegation of the EU. It's maybe the French ambassador. If you are talking about the situation in Ghana, I'm not sure it's the EU head of delegation. It could be the British ambassador. Okay, so we have to be cautious about not confusing coordination with power. My impression is that the situation with the member states is more difficult within international organizations. And this is a fantastic area for research. I'm telling that all the time to my PhD students, because everything is moving about the representation of the EU and the member states in international organization, and you have a variety of situation. Here, it's probably more difficult for the EU delegations than it is in third country. If you take the UN, it's true that there is a high coherence of position of the member state at the UN General Assembly, and this has been very well documented by quantitative studies, etc. But it's also at the General Assembly where the issues are not so important. Okay, If you take the UN Security Council, well, situation is of course much more complicated. I would say, in the routine business in international organization, it's okay, but I will not say that the EAS has the capacity to reconcile conflicting position when those positions happen. For instance, do we have to recognize Palestine as a permanent member of UNESCO? It was a complete mess, you know, between the member states, because France voted yes, Italy and United Kingdom abstained, and Germany finally voted against. Okay. Another source of conflict, which is interesting, and I would like to know more about that, is the statements which are produced by the international organizations. In 2011, United Kingdom blocked more than 80 EU declarations at the EU and OSCE on the ground that the EU position was mentioned only on behalf of the European Union. And I must say, from my interviews at the Quai d'Orsay, that the Quai d'Orsay was very happy that the Brits did the job. They didn't say anything in terms of official support, but they were very much on the same line. So this is also a source of conflict. So when I'm saying that it's easier at the vertical level than at the horizontal level, I have to introduce immediately some nuances. I got a small paper from Michael, so I would like to finish. There is another, probably another subject where we should investigate a bit more, is the question of providing information. Well, I am very struck that the various stakeholders within the EU foreign policy do not see the same added value in the information provided by the EAS. When you're talking with the European institutions, it's clear that it's an added value. When you're talking with small or middle-sized countries like Czech Republic, because this is a country I know very well, the diplomats would tell you that it is an added value, information. When talking with British and French diplomats, they will tell you that they are still waiting for the added value. Okay. This is something we have to think about. And in the future, are we going to have a system of encrypt email or cable, for instance, allowing the different embassies and the different ministries to exchange with the EAS? We are very far from that. You were talking about is the EAS providing new method to the national diplomacy, or is it reverse? My impression is that you have both, of course, but we very much concentrate our studies in the EU field on Europeanization of national practices. Here we can see also some nationalization of EU practices. For instance, writing political reports. This is not at all in the tradition of the European institutions. The people from the Commission in the delegation of the Commission, they were used to manage projects. And now there is the obligation to write political reports. I can quote a sentence from one member of the corporate board of EAS who told me, "I see right away by its style whether a report is written by an official from a national department or whether it is written by an official from the Commission." So people from the Commission have to learn how to work as national diplomats. I would like to finish by a third function which has not been investigated by Joseph, but maybe it would be good to have it on our research agenda, is producing new ideas. I have the impression that the EAS is sometimes producing new ideas, but in very very special issues. I can quote an example: under the Polish presidency, the idea for a roadmap for the neighborhood policy was launched within the Europe and Central Asia Directorate of the EAS. It is within the Crisis Management and Planning Department that the idea of creating a regional maritime capacity in the Horn of Africa was born in 2012. But what the EAS does not have is the capacity to be the producer of global strategic ideas. I'm not sure that the EAS will be able to write a general report on the security of Europe as Javier Solana did in 2003, because I'm not sure that the big member states are really supportive. My impression is that the Quai d'Orsay and the Foreign Office were not very favorable to it, because such an exercise could generate ideas that the big member states might not share. Just to conclude, I would like to go back to a remark which has been done by a previous speaker, Robert Cooper. He said, well, we're very much looking at 2013 because of the review. Yes, but more than the review, another question will be 2014, when we are going to have a new high representative. Here we have an interesting test. Because the question for us, and maybe it's a wrong question, it's to what extent do the potentialities of the EAS depend or not also on the profile of the high representative? And 2014 will be very interesting, because we'll see if the member state are going to appoint a personality with a high political profile or not. If they do not appoint somebody with a high political profile, it will mean something. It will mean that they would like to stay with the statu quo. So for me, 2014, it would be exactly the same with the EU Commission, who is going to be the president of the Commission in 2014. So it would be a very important year, because with the appointment of the personalities, we will also see which kind of EU the member states do want. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And as you can see, obviously, what we've taken up is a number of questions that already arose in different form, maybe in the first session. I'm just going to reflect on three things very, very briefly. That for me came out of what both Joseph and Christian said. One is, I suppose, the question of, well, what does the EEAS represent? And I don't mean whether it represents the EU, but what does it represent as a diplomatic organization or a diplomatic device? Joseph's question about whether the EEAS is a kind of pioneer of new forms of diplomacy, or whether it will in some way be standardized as it enters into or has entered into this organizational field, which was also touched upon by Christian, is really for me a quite important question. And that links to the second point that I would want to make. What of the EEAS as a change or innovation? In a way, and this is a fanciful comparison, but it's a bit like the election of Barack Obama. You'll see the connection, in the sense that when Obama was elected, Obama in a sense was the change, you know, a lot of the disappointment that's taken place has been partly because of the fact that people expected further transformations and changes as a result. In a way, that's true of the EEAS as well. The EEAS is the innovation, and perhaps it's expecting too much of the EEAS, certainly at this stage in its early years, to go beyond that, to innovate radically in terms of diplomatic practice. That's not to say that it hasn't innovated, but there's a sense in which you need to separate the fact that it's there from the ways in which it has actually so far transformed diplomatic practice. And that comes to the third point, which is, in a way, you know, what has the EEAS learned in 2 years? And again, you know, the answer from a lot of people would be, well, it's still a very early stage. But one of the issues is clearly, to me, whether there's been so much preoccupation with the establishment process and, in a sense, learning your position within the institutions and within the galaxy of the EU, and that has inevitably led to preoccupation, introspection, rather than extroversion in terms of the way in which the EEAS has acted. And in my pre-cooked comments, I said the question is still open whether the EEAS is the kind of pearl in the oyster or the cuckoo in the nest when it comes to EU diplomacy. We can't hope to resolve that, but a number of very interesting questions arise from that particular observation. And with that, I'll get out of the way again. What we'll do is we'll collect groups of questions and then transfer them back to Christian and Joseph. Okay, who's going to start? Go on, it's David.
Thank you. Lawrence Fulick, Treasurer of the WPCT and of Federal Union. Three short thoughts. The issue of the EU not having the capacity to recognise states, is the argument that it should be able to recognise states illustrated by the problems over Kosovo, where some member states recognised independent Kosovo and some did not? Secondly, the issue of the EEAS's overseas offices and how they structure themselves, is there not a related issue, which perhaps academics should be looking at at the same time, in the way in which EU member states structure their representations in Brussels, some of which are enormous mixtures of people from various ministries, perhaps corresponding to their domestic ministerial structure, or perhaps corresponding to the way the Commission is structured. I'm sure somebody could write a book about that, so there's an idea for some academics. Finally, again, there was mention of the issue of the next head of the EEAS. As I understand it, the Commission will fall due for renewal in 2014. There is likely to be a more political approach to the chairmanship of the Commission, with candidates being suggested by political parties perhaps before the 2014 elections. Whether or not that will have any impact on the public, I don't know. But once we've got the president of the Commission, will politics, party politics at European level, or national arguments among EU states, still be more important in choosing who succeeds Cathy Ashton, unless she is to remain? So, thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else?
Brian Crowe again. I'm interested in this thesis that the EEAS could be transformative of national representations and national ways of doing things. It seems to me that it's rather the opposite, as Robert pointed out in our first session earlier this afternoon. One of the problems for the delegations is that large parts of their staffs don't actually answer to the High Representative Vice President, even though she's the Vice President of the Commission. They answer to individual commissioners, typically the Development Commissioner and the Trade Commissioner from Geneva. Cathy Ashton's problem, subject to correction by Robert, is that although she's charged in the treaty with coordinating the external aspects of all community policies, i.e. of all the commissioners on all subjects, environment, energy, agriculture, fisheries, whatever, she has absolutely no means of doing so. And she doesn't do it, and she can't do it, quite aside from the fact she has no deputies, she doesn't have the time. Whereas well-organized national administrations, and I'd like to say the British would be one and the French would be another, the Germans probably now, they didn't used to be, but probably now, do have mechanisms in their governments to coordinate the differing priorities and views of what are called other government departments. In the UK, it's in the Cabinet Office. In France, it's the SGSAE. And so there is a mechanism for doing it. And they still find it very difficult and very often don't do it very well. But Cathy Ashton has no mechanism at all. And likewise, a British representation abroad, embassy, Brussels, Washington, posts I've served in, have large numbers of people from other government departments who are all answerable to the ambassador. Robert referred to that this afternoon. And it works. And they are, in a real sense. And they get their instructions centrally through the coordination machinery in the capital, not by telephone calls or direct messages from their own ministers. So it seems to me, at the moment anyway, it's very much national administrations being the model for the EEAS.
Okay. We take one more and then we'll allow the speakers to come back over here. Yep, put your hand up. This one.
Thank you. Ivan Newman at the LSE. This is for Josef. You made the point, and you made it elegantly, that the EEAS may turn out to be a somewhat different creature. And we've discussed this before, and I've challenged you, I'll challenge you again, because the form of the organization will depend on the functions on which it will they will carry out. And functions here simply means tasks. And whatever happens, the EEAS will have its raison d'être, and it will be dependent for its maintenance and further emergence on relations with other foreign ministries of the world outside of Europe. Now, any diplomatic organization which is set up for the purpose would have to mirror those other organizations, or else they are simply not doing their job. Which means that either the EEAS will be one of the world's foreign ministries and so not change beyond that general mold, or all the foreign ministries of the world will change. So the idea of I mean, it's very elegant, and I loved it as a hook, but I think the logic is flawed.
Okay, we'll allow the speakers to respond. So Josef first, and then Christian.
All right. Many thanks for these questions and comments. Now I'll take them one by one as they. Should be working now. Okay. I'll take them one by one. Thanks very much for those comments and interesting questions. Now, about the recognition of states and whether the EEAS should have the right to recognize states. Now, the idea is related to the fact that diplomacy and states are mutually constitutive. This is the classical idea of the English school since the 1970s. Now, the question, of course, is since diplomacy was colonized or monopolized by states, if the EEAS is to enter as a standardized foreign ministry, it will be expected to do what the other foreign ministries do, and that is establish diplomatic relations and thereby recognize other states and create other states. Now, of course, that's not happening now, and I think shouldn't be happening now, because at the moment the EEAS is at the disposal and at the political will of the member states, which still have the right to veto any joint position, because the council rules are like that in the CFSP. So the question, should it or should it not? I don't think so. I think it will have some kind of an interstitial position again, where it will be doing things, establishing representation offices as they do in Kosovo, but not necessarily having the right to bestow diplomatic recognition upon actors. Now, the question about the missions of member states in Brussels, whether that should be the whether that should be the model for EAS missions outside, I think it is in many ways a bit of a different creature, because intra-EU policies, EU policymaking, multi-level governance in the EU is very much about domestic politics inside the EU. However, there's an interesting kind of a trend going on, of course, inside the EU, and Brian Hocking and I have done a project on intra-EU diplomacy where we looked at French embassies which have been modeled on the model of the French mission to Brussels. All of their bilateral embassies inside the EU are being remodeled to that. That means there is some kind of what we call, Brian and I call, the domestication of diplomacy inside the EU on the French side. However, there's another model of transformation of intra-EU diplomatic representation, and that is the Swedish model. And what they do is they close missions. The Swedes have already closed down 6 missions inside the EU, and the reason given is exactly the same as the French say, that there's a lot of new channels of communication inside the EU. And the Swedes say, well, there's a lot of new channels of communication inside the EU. We need to close down missions. It's no longer cost-effective to have missions in most places. I will leave the question about the High Representative to Christian.
Thank you.
If I may. Yes. Brian Crowe's contention is, I agree with that, of course. I mean, at the moment, the EAS isn't structured in the same way as, for instance, the U.S. missions are, where, of course, they have all kinds of departments present in missions abroad, and the ambassador is in charge of coordinating all of that. Now, the EAS has only been around for a few years now, so it may be that the model that you are suggesting, and in fact, here the EAS could learn from the FCO or from the Canadian Department of International Affairs and Foreign Affairs and International Trade, or the U.S. State Department, in introducing a coordinator role for the heads of delegations. I think I agree with that. Now, finally, to Ivar's point, and yes, I mean, of course, the question is, of course, still on the table whether the EAS can actually belong to the field, and what will it do with the EU? If it will belong, because if indeed the EAS is to become one of the pack, that means become a foreign ministry, what is it telling us then about the EU? Well, it is telling me, at least, that it is in the process of becoming a state. And of course, that because it is a core diplomacy at the moment is a core function of statehood. There is another potential trajectory, however, and that is that Robert Cooper was saying, there are other kind of entities around which are part of the diplomatic system, but they're non-state. That is the ICRC, the Holy See, and the Maltese and the Sovereign Military Order of Malta. They have multinational diplomatic services. They have embassies. They have all the rights, all the immunities. These are medieval creatures. Indeed, they are different than states, but they are part of the system. We are currently writing a book with a colleague of mine in Prague about this. We call this the new diplomatic heteronomy, fringe players and the diplomatic order. And we are sort of asking this question, where is the EU? Now, of course, it's a kind of a radical thing to say that the Holy See and the EU may be sort of systemically in the same fold. But it might, you know, it's a nice hypothesis to explore.
Okay, Christian.
There was one question about, the model of interministerial coordination in the member states. Could it be a model for coordinating the foreign policy? The first thing I would like to say is probably yes. There always has been a lot of segmentation inside the EU institution for the management of policies. Segmentation also exists in some member states. If you take Germany, for instance, you have this old Risorgsprinzip. And the model of the Commission was probably closer from this than from the British model or from the French model, where you have more interministerial coordination done by the head of government. The problem here is a typical problem of bureaucratic politics. When Mr. Barroso decided to reorganize the portfolios, he accepted that Mrs. Ashton became the vice president in charge of external relations, but he also created a portfolio for humanitarian head, a specific portfolio for development head, a specific portfolio for humanitarian head. Why? Because at this time he wanted to protect also the power of the commission from the next EAS, you know, which was not set up at this time. So this is classically the result of bureaucratic politics, and this is something we find also in the national context. I think one mistake would be to consider that any institution could be at the national or at the EU level should be something rational. It never exists, you know, a rational institution. It's always the result of compromises, political transactions, etc. And it was clearly the case. And you now, when you are a civil servant inside the EAS or a civil servant inside the Commission, you have to do with that and try to find your own way to work with your colleagues in formality or institutionalization. But it's true that it's with DEFCO, with the development Directorate General, a sort of strong bureaucratic entity within the Commission, that the difficulties have been the higher with the AS. Mutualization. Here, I think we have to see very different expectation from the member states. Sweden was quoted. It's a country which is in favor of mutualization and closing embassies. Ireland has also interest for that. So relatively small or middle-sized member states. Then when you are talking with French diplomats or British diplomats, well, there is no plan to close embassies, even if it costs a lot of money. But the question is not about money. The question is about symbolics. That's very interesting, because even if you do not have the financial capacities, you prefer to have your bilateral embassy, okay, with one ambassador, one advisor, and a secretary. Full stop. This is the model of embassies we have more and more in many countries. For the FCO or for the Quai d'Orsay. The points about permanent representation, when you say that there is different model, I mean the permanent representation of the member states in Brussels, it's true, but there is a general tendency to have not only representatives of the foreign affairs, but also representatives from all other ministries. The number is different from one member state to another, but this is also linked to the distance from Brussels. You know, if you are the Netherlands, or if you are France, it's relatively easy to send your people to Brussels. If you are Greece or if you are Portugal, it's more difficult. So you need to have more staff posted in Brussels. But you're right; could be a model for what a new diplomatic service should be, or a new delegation. Not only the representation of the Chancery and the MFAs, but also of the other ministries, you know, from a government. So yes, it's probably a good point.
I think I'm looking at David here. Should we be coming to a close because we're over here?
Thank you, Donald Prentice, Ship Peace Practitioners. We've had a lot of use of language of administration or even the language for statecraft. I'd like to look at the language of urgency, the language of threats and challenges. There are currently huge threats and challenges on the fringe of Europe, which are being very adequately managed by OSCE missions. But for a cogent EAAS to actually justify itself, to merit itself, surely there should be a sense of urgency, because the cost of armies dwarfs the cost of diplomacy.
Thank you. There was one over here for sure. There's one there. Yeah.
Okay. Hi, Claude Queen from College of Europe. It's just a question from Monsieur Le Quin. It's concerning what you said about the small member states, particularly Ireland. You said there's perhaps a quasi-permissive consensus for small to medium member states to accept the EAS, but then there's conflict with also large member states. Do you see a possible fracture for this reason? And if so, what would you suggest for larger member states? Should they simply, as Cooper mentioned, retain their traditional embassies, because it's such a symbolic element for them. Thank you.
And there's one over here. Yep.
Alan Murray, I'm the chair of the European Network on Religion and Belief. Earlier this year, we organized a conference in conjunction with the presidency of the European Parliament on the topic of security in Europe in relation to religion and belief. And we were considerably surprised when we had three applications from officials in the EEAS and only one from the Equalities and Fundamental Rights Directorate of the DG Justice, which is where we normally sit. So I just really want to ask the question, one or two people have mentioned it earlier, of where exactly does security fit and how does the EEAS relate to the Commission on these issues?
Yes, I'm going to answer your question. You're probably right. Symbolics is not only an issue for the big member states. It could be an issue for any member state. It depends very much the region of the world. If you take Czech Republic, for instance, having embassies in the West Balkans or having embassy in Belarus, in terms of symbolics, it's very important still. Anyway, my impression is that it is in these countries where you have probably the highest level of acceptability about mutualization of the foreign policies. The Visegrad country started already. You opened some, not joint embassy, but joint building. You have a joint building in Cape Town for your consulates, the French and the Germans also share a building in Ulaanbaatar. It's not in Moscow, it's in Ulaanbaatar. But it's clear that this is from the small member state that this idea of, closing bilateral embassies and replacing them by European embassies can be pushed, okay? With one problem, and again, I am taking the Czech case because I did interviews on that in Prague recently. the staff of the ministries of foreign affairs in a country like Czech Republic is the same in Slovakia, is a limited staff. So if you have four heads of delegations, and this is the case for the Czechs, they have four heads of delegation now, EU delegation, two deputy heads, it means that six of your brightest national diplomats have left Prague for, 8 years. Especially if you compare also the level of the salaries as a national diplomat in the Central European countries and as a diplomat at the EAS. There's no comparison. There's no comparison. So there is an incentive to stay 8 years, especially if you have a family. This is a problem that I see sometimes, and a limit also to the question of more mutualization coming from the small member states.
Yes, just as a side note in relation to what just Christian just said, the Slovaks only have one head of delegation. It's actually in Benghazi.
Yes.
Of all places.
Yeah.
But
the Czech is Baghdad.
Yes. There you go. But the reason why we don't have so many heads of delegations is a structural reason. Number one, not many Slovak diplomats speak French, and most of these positions you actually do need to speak French. And number two, most of the Slovak, even the high-ranking diplomats, have no experience from running large embassies because Slovakia does not have large embassies. And you need to have that. So there are, all this talk about disadvantages to Central and Eastern European diplomats. I think that's more ideology than reality. The reality is simple structural factors that lead to lower chances for Central European diplomats. But then, just to come back to the questions that were raised, and I'd like to take two of those, and that is the sense of urgency. I think just a general comment. I think that's absolutely right. The kind of crisis that we are going through, including the Arab Spring, might be both a curse and a blessing for the EAS, because in crisis times you get faster rates of learning. You see that in the military organizations and in other kinds of, but it also could lead to all kinds of breakdowns. So I think it remains to be seen what this is for the EAS, whether the Arab Spring, for instance, is a blessing or a curse. I'm not sure for the EAS. Now, in terms of the, and I'm not sure in general, actually, but, and in terms of the security, I think what's interesting about the, of course, you have the crisis management components in the organizational charts. You see that pretty well in the EAS as to where it is located organizationally. However, what the EAS also does is that they are developing what they call crisis management platforms in relation to all kinds of organizational units in the Commission and also in the Council Secretariat. And this is the way how they get plugged into the conveyor belt in these two organizations, and I think we will see more of that in various formats. So, I think that's all I'd say.
Right, well, thank you very much to both speakers, because they've taken us on from the themes that were set up earlier, and they've also raised a number of questions I'm sure we'll be coming back to later on. So thank you very much. Both of you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike.